Committee on Environment and Energy, Friday, April 24th, 1987, 1 p.m., Hearing Room E. Work session, House Bill 2663, House Bill 3162, House Bill 3097, House Bill 2936, House Bill 3001.
Hope he's not being stopped. He's right. He's right somewhere.
Boy, I don't have money on me.
Good, you can sleep in. Are we ready to go? Ron, are we ready? Okay, all right. I'll call this session of the House Environment and Energy Committee to order. The clerk will note that everyone's here except Representative Johnson. He should be along in a bit. We have on the session today only work sessions. And the first one we will take up is House Bill 2663 and House Bill 3162. And I believe the group is going to combine those. But at this point, I'll ask Representative Ekus, I guess Greg Ribbing, Ron, whoever your group is that you want to have with you. Why don't you come up to the table?
Throw me down there.
Yeah, why don't you? Probably be easier. Is Eric Station here? Station? Eric, why don't you come up too? And Ray, come on up. Yeah, come on up. Let me ask Representative Ekus, since we can have a hearing on more than one bill. Actually, when we do a work session, it should be on one bill. Which bill are we dealing with, Ron?
We are dealing with House Bill 2663-5 amendments, which actually combine the provisions of three bills.
All right, so then we'll have the work session actually formally then on House Bill 2663. I will open that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The product before you is came out of subcommittee yesterday after many hours of working with representatives of the telephone industry, public interest groups, and the Public Utility Commission and the Adult and Family Services, as well as representatives of the committee, representatives that were of the community that were concerned about House Bill 3162. It appeared before you at a hearing we held a few weeks ago. This legislation has one general overall focus, which is the maintenance of universal service. To do that, we have combined three different pieces of legislation into one. First is, I believe, was 2596, which was the medically needy shutoff bill. The second was 2663, which was the Lifeline telephone service bill. And the third is 3162, which provided access to telephone devices for the deaf. We've taken those three bills, along with another provision that we considered important for a universal service goal, and that was the deposit and installation charges review by the Public Utility Commission. So essentially, in the effort to maintain universal service, we have a Public Utility Commission review of deposit and installation charges with the idea of trying to remove those as barriers to having telephones. And in many cases, studies have shown that those costs are a greater barrier to having and using a telephone than are the monthly service charges. We have in the bill the protections against shutoff for those people who are medically in need of having a telephone. We have the establishment of a new assistance, monthly assistance plan within the confines of the FCC program that we talked about previously. And then we have a revised version of 3162. We have looked at the funding mechanisms for these. I believe that most of us involved would prefer that funding mechanism be done through the general fund. I think it's simply a recognition of political reality that that is not likely, since we were probably talking about between $1 to $2 million for the program. So we did not pursue the general fund possibility. We have chosen to fund it through a surcharge on per access line with a cap of 25 cents. 15 cents of that would go to the monthly assistance program. 10 cents would go to the Deaf Access Program, with the expectation that once that program was up and going, the 10 cents would gradually decline. There were several considerations from brought to us by several interests. If you recall 2663, it was presented to us by the Oregon Independent Telephone Association, and it was based upon general fund source of revenue. It was based upon monthly assistance, and it was based upon a cap of eligibility of the telephone cost had to be $15 a month for the local exchange rate. We did not adopt that approach. However, we tried to accommodate some of those concerns. For example, instead of a cap at $15 or eligibility at $15, we have specific language that contemplates the Public Utility Commission providing a different level of assistance based upon the local exchange rate. In other words, someone who had a monthly phone local exchange rate of $8 would not necessarily receive the same assistance as someone who had a monthly phone rate of $16. We tried also to take into account some of the concerns which the telephone companies had, specifically that their administrative costs be reimbursed, specifically that the surcharge for this program be line item on the budget and clearly identified as such. We also had a great deal of discussion over the eligibility for the various programs. The deposit and installation charges is not particularly limited to low income. The medically needy is not particularly limited to low income. However, the monthly assistance program is limited to those who deemed to be or certified to be eligible for food stamps. Not that you are on food stamps, but certified to be eligible. If you recall in testimony at our hearing on Lifeline, we had some discussion about those who would be eligible for food stamps, but for various reasons don't apply for or receive food stamps, but as far as household income goes, would qualify. An advantage with food stamps is that the eligibility is based upon household income. So we have used the household income criteria for food stamps as the eligibility determination, but not limited to the fact that you actually have to receive food stamps. We had a great deal of discussion as well on whether or not, on what the administrative costs were likely to be and ways in which we could reduce the administrative costs. After a great deal of discussion with the Adult and Family Services and with some hope that there would be some way through computer exchange of service address and phone numbers that we could reduce administrative costs that way, it appeared that that might not be possible. We ended up with, in order to reduce administrative costs and also reduce the burden on the Public Utility Commission, that we allow for the Public Utility Commission to contract with other agencies. We had in mind Adult and Family Services as well as the Low Income Energy Assistance Program, believing that the Low Income Assistance Program may be able to provide the certification process at a cheaper cost than Adult and Family Services, fully anticipating that if we put too great a burden on Adult and Family Services, they weren't necessarily going to get the general fund money to reimburse them to the level that it would need. So we have tried in every way possible to provide leeway for reduced administrative costs of the program. I might go section by section through the bill and explain generally what's here, and then Mr. Gribling, who's worked a great deal on the bill, and Mr. Station and Mr. Astley can
everybody's
present their comments.
Excuse me, thank you. Everybody's got the dash 5. That's the base operation. Thank you.
Okay. Starting with section 2, which is just a declaration of a basic goal, which is to for the state to assure that adequate, affordable residential telecommunication service is available to all citizens of the state. Section 3 is our deposit and installation approach. Allows the commission to require the utilities to assure either time payment plans for deposits and installation charges, or, and I think this is important because it won't always be time payment plans, or such other options as may be appropriate for a particular telecommunications public utility. In some cases, installation charges are already low enough that there might not be any need to change, and in some cases, a number of the telephone companies are looking at the possibility of not having any deposit charges at all. So we are not looking specifically at requiring time payment plans, but allowing other options. But it does provide the review of those plans with the idea of eliminating those as a barrier to having a telephone. Section 4 provides some general authority for the commission that's particularly appropriate to the monthly assistance plan. Sub 1 provides authority which the commission does not now have to approve a different rate for low-income customers than the rate charged to other residential customers. In there for two reasons. One, to make sure they have the authority, and two, to allow continuation of the existing program, the telephone assistance program, until the program contemplated in this bill is up and running. The second is this sub 2 is establishment of plans or requiring the telecommunications utilities to establish plans to educate customers on the options that are available for obtaining telecommunication services. I think many of us in our working group believe that in many cases, it may be more efficient and least costly to educate customers about the options available to them than it is to provide the assistance. And also, it's clear that in order to let people know about the assistance that is available and in order to reduce the administrative costs of whatever plan the PUC comes up with, it may be more cost effective to put your money into education than it is into some other administrative costs. Section 5 is really the provisions that the subcommittee had previously adopted on the medically needy shutoff. It requires the commission to establish rules for the method of determining when the termination of residential service would significantly endanger the physical health of the residential customer. The commission shall require each utility to accept a medical statement by a licensed physician or a licensed nurse practitioner as evidence of endangerment of health, to establish the procedures for submitting and receiving the statements, and to establish the period for the length by which the medical statement should be valid or after which it must be renewed. And there's an exemption there that the rules will not apply to any other telecommunication service other than the local exchange residential service. In other words, it does not apply to the costs that are raised in long-distance call.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Soa.
What, in line 12, what's your determination as being a licensed physician?
We have gone through this before. Might have the Public Utility Commission explain what they do now with the term licensed physician. We pulled this language out of their current rule.
That's not necessary, Mr. Chairman. Right. They've addressed it so that it's a broad-based.
It is broad-based. There's some concern about the fact that it is broad-based. The fact is that we are talking about very few numbers of people in these instances.
Thank you.
There, sub 5 makes it clear that by this medical statement and the prevention of shutoff does not mean that you get free telephone service. It requires that you are not excused from paying for telecommunication service, that you are required to enter into a time payment agreement with the utility if an overdue balance exists, and you are subject still to being cut off if the customer refuses to enter into or fails to abide by the terms of a payment agreement. Sub 6 is an exemption for those telephone companies that do not have the technical ability to terminate toll telecommunication service without terminating the local exchange service. Section 6 begins to outline the monthly assistance plan. It requires the Commission to establish a plan to provide assistance to the low-income customers through differential rates or otherwise. Specifically ask that the plan be designed to use to the maximum extent possible the available funding offered by the Federal Communications Commission. And we've included specific language that allows the Commission to provide a different level of assistance based upon the local exchange rate, as I talked about earlier. sub 2 requires that all the public utilities cooperative, that everybody participate. And this was a question raised about the co-ops, which we've had the legislation previously, of their whether or not they were under the PUC or not. They now, under the legislation that the House passed, would require them to have a certificate of authority or allow them to. This makes it clear that co-ops do participate also, but the intent is not that co-ops, by participating, then all of a sudden become re-regulated by the Public Utility Commission. Sub 3 is what I've called the open door to allow a telephone company to come in with its own plan. Company can come in and say, we can reach this many people with this plan or providing these options, and we can do it at less cost. Then this allows the Public Utility Commissioner to approve that plan and allow them an exemption from participating in the monthly assistance plan. And I can see the offering of some options under some circumstances where that may in fact be the case. And we have so many different options out there, and different companies looking at different packages of options or options to be available to various customers, not just low-income customers, that it was our feeling that there needs to be an open door where we do not necessarily have to get locked into the monthly assistance plan, which will the way we have it written will be formulated within the context of the FCC. And while I don't want it dictated by the FCC, the PUC plan is within that umbrella, and we wanted to have some leeway for some other options, particularly since phone companies themselves have been developing a great many different options or packages of options. Sub 4 It's a language that allows the Public Utility Commission to contract with another agency to administer the assistance plan. And sub 5 is our definition of low-income customer for as used in this section, an individual determined by the commission to have been certified as meeting eligibility criteria for federal food stamps. Section 7 is 7 and 8 are the funding mechanisms. Section 7 specializes that the in order to fund the program, the commission shall develop and implement a system for a surcharge in amount not to exceed 25 cents, 15 cents into the monthly assistance plan, 10 cents into the deaf access program. Sub 2 makes it clear that the monies collected by the surcharge are not to be considered in any proceeding to establish rates for the telecommunications service. You don't want to be assessing this surcharge and then have to go through a rate proceeding and the money collected from the surcharge being considered as part of the revenues in the company for the rate proceeding.
Representative Peters.
While you're on that, Ron, how is that actually identified in a bill? What will it be called on that bill? Do we know yet, or does that have to be developed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, in Section 8, we have called this fund the Residential Service Protection Fund. I'm not sure that we have specified how it would be identified on the bill, but the fund would be called the Residential Service Protection Fund. It's entirely possible there'd just be a line that says Residential Service Protection Fund, 25 cents.
Thank you.
The commission could, however, I believe, specify some other wording.
Chairman? Yes, Representative Parkinson.
Ron, the 25 cents, is that, would it all go into a common pool statewide, or is it company by company?
It is one fund to be distributed on the basis of, you will have various levels of participation in the fund, depending on how many of the qualifying customers under the low-income definition are in each company's territory.
The entire state.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Sub 3 is the specific direction that for identifying separately in the bills for service the surcharge that is imposed. Now, that doesn't specify the language, it just requires that there be a separate line item. Section 8 is the section setting up the funds. So what we really have is a Residential Service Protection Fund. We've called the 15-cent fund the account for low-income customers. The account for the deaf is established as the 10 cents. So we've got one fund with two accounts in it. Section 9 begins our 3162 language. One definition has been added, and that's this on page 6, line 11, severely hearing impaired, or excuse me, line 14, severely speech impaired, has been added. Section 10 is the general language recognizing the problem and the need and specifying the establishment of a program. I call your attention to lines on page 7, line 23 and 24, which we have added that the equipment would be provided on a loan basis to be returned if the recipient moves out of state. Section 11 requires the Public Utility Commission to establish and administer the program to purchase and distribute the devices. Section 12 establishes a telecommunication device for the Deaf Advisory Committee to advise the PUC on the program. Section 13 language requiring the employment of a coordinator for the program. All the testimony we had indicated that you would need to at least have a coordinator for it. Sub 2 of that section allows the commission to contract out with any governmental agency to assist in the program. I might stop here and point out what we contemplate here is there is an existing program, the Hearing Impaired and Deaf Access Program of Department of Human Resources. And a representative of that program is here today if you have any questions about that. It is anticipated, Representative Peters.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Peters.
And maybe you're going to get to this, but I assume there was a reason that that committee wasn't used and there was a separate committee set up. I mean, is there just no possibility of overlap there?
What we set up was an advisory committee. What the question was whether or not the PUC should do the program or the Deaf Access existing Deaf Access Program should run the program. We were in a situation where we have been working with the Public Utility Commission. We were asking the commission to collect the money. And I really asked myself, who should do this? And for the time being, we felt that the best thing to do was to at least provide that the Public Utility Commission, because they do have some experience at least with this and with telecommunications, and since they are collecting the money, that they ought to at least be in a position to provide oversight and review and approval of any budget. And because we had not heard to any great degree from the Deaf Access Program itself, the working group and the subcommittee felt that it was better to maintain the PUC in a position of review and approval of the budget, since we're talking about a good deal of money here. But I'll allow them the ability to contract with the Deaf Access Program to really provide, to really carry out the program. The PUC, I think, would prefer that they just collect the money. But with a real unfamiliarity with the Deaf Access Program and a lack until yesterday of any real testimony from the program, it was our feeling that we ought to at least put the PUC in a position, since they're going to be partly held responsible just by virtue of the fact they're collecting the money, that there ought to be a review and approval of any budget and any program. And it would be my hope that the Deaf Access Program and the PUC itself, they begin discussions on how this might be carried out. And it's entirely possible that before this legislation is through the process, that another arrangement would be worked out. But that was our feeling.
Representative Peterson.
I don't have any problem with the PUC doing it. I guess maybe the question I'm trying to ask is there not some sort of committee out there already dealing with the deaf that could serve as the advisory committee? It sounds like you're setting up a new committee and new staff. And I'm wondering if there isn't something that exists already.
We are setting up additional staff, essentially, for this. The Deaf Access Program has, I believe they said they had 3 people. Well,
how many?
I think the question is whether or not there's an existing advisory committee. Is that correct?
An existing committee dealing with the problems of the deaf, whether it's in human resources, that could serve this same function.
Let me have Mr. Earwood from the Deaf Access Program, if he's here, okay, answer that question for you.
Thank you.
Can you give us your name again for the record, sir?
I am Carl Earwood, State Coordinator of the Deaf and Hearing Impaired Access Program from the Department of Human Resources. To respond to your question, yes, I do have an advisory committee that represents deaf and hearing impaired professionals, parents, a variety of different groups on to advise me on this program. Yes, ma'am.
Then maybe my question back to Representative Ekus, if I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, is that committee, could it not serve this same purpose?
Yes, I believe it could. There was nothing that prevents some of the same people serving. I'm not sure it has the same membership listed here, does it have the same membership?
The type of membership which is listed in your current bill, perhaps the only modification we might need to make is to add Section C, a member from a Public Utility Commission, and one representative from the telephone company. Other than that, we have a variety of deaf and hearing impaired people on our advisory committee. And as I said, they represent a variety of different groups, professionals, parents, deaf children, deaf consumers. So probably we just need to add those two to our advisory committee.
Okay, but again, there's no staff that could just be transferred over. Is that right?
No, Mr. Irwin's testimony indicated that there were three staff, two full-time and one part-time, not contemplated that that staff could absorb this program. I think that's also one reason why we're looking at a separate advisory committee, although it could include some of the, could overlap to some extent, but this is a fairly, can be a fairly
that all oriented toward addressing that very issue.
Thank you.
Dick, let me ask you to respond to that, and I think Jim Ross is here. If Jim wants to come up and say anything, we'd be happy to take that, Jim, as we work through this. Go ahead, Dick.
This is responding to the question about the criteria that describe what a small resort is, or the back on the secondary lands one.
Well, I think back on this, and then we can go forward on these other items, but I think back on this suggestion of changes to Section 12.
Okay. This morning, I read the language in Section 12 that I drafted. This is in my amendments, dash three, I guess. Right. Okay. I read that to Jim Ross over the phone to see what his reaction to it was, and he said that he thought that was fine. The change that is suggested by Representative Anderson, I think, is acceptable, provided that we're talking about putting it into my amendments, because we still have the difference, and I might as well make sure we all understand the difference. If you go with my amendments, you are not directing the commission to authorize destination resorts in secondary lands. You're directing them to adopt a definition of secondary lands by this date. So you need Section 11 if you want them to consider by that date, or, and make up their minds by that date, whether they want destination resorts and secondary lands.
And you see, that's the sticking point.
That's the sticking
point. And we're saying that, quite the opposite, that the legislature has decided that destination resorts can be cited under all these strict criteria on secondary resorts.
Can I?
Go ahead.
Let me give you the argument that I've made why we shouldn't tie the commission's hand on this. And I think Representative Agron's touched upon it in his opening remarks. There has been a process underway, sponsored by LCDC for the last 16 months or so, with about 30 participants, everybody, trying to define secondary lands and the uses that might be authorized on them. We're getting much closer. We are fairly close, I think, to settling it. But what you have to understand about that is it's a very organic process. People are thinking about what secondary lands is and how to define it with a mind to what kinds of uses are authorized on those secondary lands. If the legislature comes down with this bill or any other bill and suddenly says these uses will be authorized on secondary lands, that's going to change the nature of the entire debate among the people who have been working on this for a long time. At this point, they have not been contemplating destination resorts on secondary lands. Frankly, I think that when we get to the point of discussing what kinds of uses finally should be authorized on secondary lands, I think we may get someplace with destination resorts. But I'm against truncating that debate here because of the implications it has for everything that's being talked about.
Tim, you want to come up? You want to respond to this issue and either help us or confuse us further?
I thought you were doing just fine.
All right. You mean being confused or what?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
I guess I keep going back to Section 12 of the new language, which I believe is sufficient without Section 11, because it tells the commission to adopt the submitted definition, and it doesn't say anything about destination resort. It says definition of secondary resource lands and uses permitted on secondary resource lands.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parkinson.
I understand what you're saying, Andy, but I don't think it gets you where you want to be. And I think everybody here is agreeing with me. What if the commission would say that the destination resorts are not permitted on secondary lands? What would that?
Still would be worthless.
Yeah. All that work down the tube.
Yeah. Well, that's
yes, Representative Ickes. Go ahead, Dick, and then Representative Ickes.
It's not the case that the bill would be worthless. The bill would still authorize small resorts on the million acres of committed exceptions areas and non-resource lands.
Okay.
But it's true that you would leave it up to the commission to decide whether they would be authorized on secondary lands.
Okay, Representative Ickes.
Well, I guess I'm reading it the same way Representative Parkinson is. That if you require them to adopt and submit a definition of secondary resource lands and the uses, you have no guarantee they'll even consider whether destination resorts are there. And so Section 11 guarantees that at least they'll consider it.
Yeah, it does. I would have to agree with that. That Section 11 says you shall consider it, then you still got the options of deciding whether you want to permit them or not, but you are directed to consider them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
Could I ask Russ Nibon a question?
Yes, you may.
Russ, what was it you wanted to add? You moved up there, you must have had a reason.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Russ Nibon for the County Planning Directors. I think Representative Anderson's concurrence in Section 12 was assuming that it was going to be added into the Dash 2 amendments, and the Dash 2 amendments specify already that small-scale destination resorts shall be allowed on secondary resource lands.
Okay.
And what that would have done then is put closure on that issue by directing the commission to do it by a time certain. And they link together that way.
Representative Parkinson.
Russ, have you been part of this working group?
Yes.
You're probably been as hung up as all the rest of us. I guess my question was, is there another way to tackle this where the commission by rule could decide which secondary lands that be permitted on or something?
Chairman, Representative Parkinson, I think it's a simple case of whether the legislature wants to make that decision now and let the commission just decide what is secondary land, or whether you want to defer both issues to the commission.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parkinson.
Richard has a problem with roping it up half the state or something. What I'm saying is, in this bill, could we not say they shall allow them on secondary land, but the commission maybe would have an input on what types of the locations of secondary land or whatever? Is there another way to do it? Am I making sense?
Yes. We think you are.
Maybe
Chairman,
I think Mr. Ross.
You're talking about wording that would say that the legislature directs the commission to identify destination resorts as appropriate on some secondary land.
Maybe
that would mandate
that
there has to be some that's appropriate, but that it leaves it open that there might be other secondary lands that would not be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, that would give direction to the commission. But it wouldn't. They wouldn't have to allow them on all secondary lands.
Well, let me ask you something. I think we're anxious to resolve. I think the substantive issue, but I got a political issue that I'm very much concerned about as well. And that is, I think whatever we come up with here, we could probably pass it without problem. Before, I'd just sooner avoid a bruising battle on the land use issue, because I'd like to also get it out of the Senate. And
because I think it's worth doing. I think it's worth coming to some sort of resolution on this particular issue. So if we can come up with some sort of at least generalized agreement on this, I think we could. This seems to be the biggest sticking point, is it not, at this stage?
Yeah, I would say so.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Representative Parkinson.
Would it be appropriate to hear from Mr. Ross?
Yes. He seems somewhat reluctant, but...
Well, Jim Ross, Director, Department of Land Conservation and Development. I guess if you were going to ask the commission to take a look at the secondary lands category and making some of that land available for smaller destination resorts, you might want to do it back on page 2A, subsection, or section 4, subsection 6, where you talk about the lands where destination resorts of this nature would be allowed to site, and you can include, and on secondary resource lands as identified by LCDC at that point.
Which copy are we using?
Yeah.
He's
suggesting that Mr. Ross is suggesting is what's in 2.
Dash 2?
Yes.
It could be what it's in.
Section 4. Okay.
This is what.
This
should be
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this wording, though, is not that clear. It's still ambiguous. I'd read this. It could be read that if they define a secondary resource land, you would then allow destination resort.
Yeah.
And I think what I was trying to get at was that the commission by rule could narrow that to some extent.
Right.
Where so identified by the commission.
The point I was making, Mr. Chairman, was not to have all secondary lands necessarily made available to smaller destination resort sitings without an exception. But the instruction in the statute that secondary resource lands would be available in those instances where LCDC identified that type of secondary resource land as being suitable.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Parker.
Mr. Ross, could you tell us just a little bit off the top of your head what some possible criteria would be? What would you use for criteria on secondary resource land? Would you use it to protect in a certain area? Which direction would you come from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, that's a difficult issue here because I don't think it really matters that much in terms of the kind of land a destination resort goes on. Obviously, we probably don't want to put it on the very best agricultural land or forest land that we have. I think there are other factors, and the question that needs to be asked is, are there other adequate measures in this bill to ensure that what is being cited is in fact a small destination resort? And if those factors are there, I don't think it matters that much if it's on the best of the secondary lands. I think the bill is greatly improved. It's close. I don't think it's quite all the way there yet in terms of ensuring that you don't end up in some instances, and I don't know how much of a problem it is yet, my glass ball's not that good, with some super motels that are really attracting the passerby rather than the destination type person who's going from point A to point B to enjoy a resource. And that's what destination resorts are about.
Representative Agam.
Well, the criteria that have been listed in there that Mr. Benner has inserted that say that the resort shall primarily provide access to a recreational resort.
That's good.
And that which can only reasonably be enjoyed and provide lodging and other services in support of access to that resource. That goes a long ways toward precluding the motel type situation, I think. And it also says that you don't go out just anywhere and say, you know, throw a rock and say, I'm going to build one here. It says there has to be a reason for it, connected with some natural feature that people want to come and spend some time with. So I think that should allay that motel fear to some very, very major.
In addition to that, I would say you also have the buffer.
Yeah. Well, yes, from the prime agricultural land, yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
I wonder if Jim might be able to give us some language that we could hook into Section 12 that would be more acceptable to everybody.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've only seen this material just in the past half hour, although
well, if that's
I did talk by phone this morning.
Longer than we have, so go ahead.
Okay. I'm satisfied with the Section 11 and 12 language that is there. I think the Commission would give serious consideration to the secondary resource lands and destination resort use question with that kind of instruction to them.
You don't see any problem with Section 12 and adding the word adopt?
Oh, certainly not.
Okay.
And I certainly do not see a problem with July 31st, 1988. If we haven't adopted something by then, we should be chastised. I think we'll have something in the next three or four months.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
What 12 are we talking about? We talking the Benner amendments?
Yeah. The 11 and 12 are in his amendments on page 8.
Right.
We've got a little bit on both of these. We're going to have to come back and pull these pieces together. But for now, let's just discuss these thorny issues, and then we can come back and look at it a bit more specifically. Yes.
If I could, for the record, without having had an opportunity to absorb more of the changes that have been made, I would be opposed to opening all secondary resource lands at this point. But I don't think that is where the attention ought to be provided. It's on whether or not there are enough limiting factors to ensure you don't have roadside motels. And maybe there are.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parkinson.
Mr. Ross, say that you studied these and you found out that there were enough limiting factors, you wouldn't be concerned about locating these on any secondary resource land in the state.
If there are adequate factors to ensure that we're not talking about some super roadside motels, but truly destination-type resorts, I'm not concerned about them being on secondary
land. And I'll throw one more thing out to Mr. Benner. If he came up with the opinion that they could adequately define it so there wouldn't be damage or anything, has anybody thought about a sunset? Whereas the question would have to be studied in 4 years or 2 years, and if damage is being done, it automatically would be re-studied. Is any discussion like that taking place?
No, we hadn't, if I may, Mr. Chairman. And I wouldn't have too much problem with that, except I want to have more than a 2 or 4 year sunset. It would seem to me that these sorts of things are not going to happen very frequently. We're not talking about, you know, a whole horde of people who are waiting to rush out into the open and start doing these things. They'll happen rather rarely and over a long period of time. And so if a sunset makes sense, and I don't have any big hang up with that, I'd say maybe 8 years or something. Give it a chance to get some experience, because I think it would take that long to get 2 or 3 or 4. Even if you had the law today and somebody had decided, well, good, I'm going to look around and see whether I can work something out. By the time you made the investigation, by the time you did, you know, you went through this process, by the time you got some engineering and design and financing, my good heavens, it could be 4 or 5 years before anybody opened any doors, you see. So it would need a long period.
Anyone else want to come in on that?
I have a question.
Representative
Mr. Ross, I'd like to ask you, you know, this thing seems to center about the objection of this so-called motel term. Why don't you just put it in the bill prohibiting it? Pardon my naive and lack of knowledge about land use, but what's so wrong with just prohibiting that?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there is a fine line that makes it very difficult to determine the difference between a certain type of motel and something that is in fact a destination facility. And that's what today we've been struggling with and trying to determine whether the amendments that I understood being proposed were adequate to provide that kind of protection. I concluded initially that they went a long ways, but I was not satisfied they had gone far enough. Mm-hmm. But I'm not prepared to offer you any other amendments to solve the problem yet. But I am interested in still working on that.
The In the Seventh Mountain comes to mind as just an example of what could be a motel or a destination resort, I guess.
We would consider that a destination resort.
Okay. And how about Salishan or Caneda? Those are all destination resorts.
Yes.
And yet, as Mr. Benner and I were saying the other day, if I'm in the Bend area and I'm staying overnight, I always phone Sun River to see if I can stay overnight. I'd rather stay there and enjoy their facilities.
Sure.
So, you know, I guess whatever you do, it's going to some small degree, become that sort of thing. And yet people go to Salishan to have a convention and to play some golf and to enjoy the coast and so forth and stay 3 or 4 days, as I have many times, all of you have. So I don't know how you make that distinction.
I get what you're asking.
Yeah, well, there's some fine lines. I can remember when I was much younger, there was a destination resort in Willamette Pass called McCready Hot Springs. And there was a little river there and all these hot springs and diving boards and everything. And it was literally within 50 yards of the Willamette Pass Highway, with fir trees and the stream and all of that. But it was definitely a destination resort. Not to say that an occasional trucker didn't go in and stay overnight.
Jim?
Mr. Chairman, what we're experiencing now...
I know it wasn't Representative Anderson anyway.
What we're talking about now is the same issue that bogged the commission down over a year ago when we were trying to look at the destination resort issue. And we finally did, of course, as you know, adopt a destination resort program under Goal 8, the recreation needs of the state, and the statewide planning goals. We ended up, though, in ensuring that we had a definitive line between motels and the like and destination resorts, having criteria that very clearly drew that difference. We knew that there was a whole category of other types of resorts that we were not providing this fast-track process under Goal 8 in terms of siting, but we ultimately became frustrated in trying to deal with the issue, the very question that Representative Johnson has asked, and that's how do you sort between the two? I think you're getting close. I think there should be some kind of either legislation or another look by our agency and commission at the smaller destination resort issue, although I also will say in the same breath, I think that the exceptions process does do an adequate job and does work in citing these other types of facilities. And I know there's controversy on that point.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how close we are. Go ahead. There are other elements to the bill that can briefly be described.
All right, go ahead, Dick.
Just one more point on whether the legislature ought to authorize these on secondary lands. When we came into the session, we knew that there was some interest in secondary lands in the legislature, as there obviously was in 1985. That's where the direction to LCDC to do something on secondary lands came from. It's unfortunate that we couldn't resolve the thing before the session got started, but it's complicated. I'm confident that we're going to get there. But you have this bill, you have a secondary lands bill in committee that you're going to look at on Monday. There's a bill on the Senate side which comes at it from the Farm Bureau side and tries, as do these other two bills, to have an effect on that debate. I'm opposed to all three of them because I think we ought to respect that process. I'm opposed to the Farm Bureau bill, which would take non-farm dwellings out of the EFU zone because that's one of the things being debated in the secondary lands debate. I'm opposed to the bill you're going to hear on Monday, which has its own definition of secondary lands. I think we ought to let that process play itself through.
Mr. Chairman?
President Parkinson.
Mr. Benner, I really understand what you're saying. I can really understand where you're coming from on that. But getting back to what we talked about a minute ago, would you be at all comfortable with the commission by rule defining what secondary lands these places could be located on? Do you think there's a chance for it there?
I think that if you tell them to consider it, they will do it. In the same way that they're doing what you told them to consider doing in 85. Because this issue came up in this bill, I've talked to some farmers about it, and they felt that they would not resist dealing with resorts on secondary lands in the course of that debate for one very simple reason, and that is they want the secondary lands thing to succeed. They want the counties to get enough out of the process so they will actually, it's voluntary, so they will actually do it so the farmers get better protection on the better land. I don't think there will be a great deal of resistance to it, but I think it ought to happen in that process.
Well, I guess the question I have then in Section 11 and 12, there seems to be, I think, some general agreement with that, with the addition of the word adopt, but I'm not quite sure how this then relates to everything else. Maybe the thing to do, Representative Anderson.
But, you know, I don't really have a problem with 11 and 12, but I think somewhere in the bill we need to say that this legislative is interested and wants to have small destination resorts and give that direction. It's our policy.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, as I glance down through the rest of them, I think that in Section 5 we're okay. In Section 6 we've agreed on some things, no problem. Section 8, the Dash 2 amendments would have eliminated all mapping requirements. That was not our intention, at least not wasn't mine, as the issue arose, but rather to not require it for the small destination resorts and leave it as it is for the others as presently constituted. And I think that your amendments accomplish that. So we have agreement there. Sections 9 and 10 were amended to conform to the Jefferson County, Jefferson County. House Bill 2758 in any case, and so you know, took out any potential redundancy or conflict, whatever, there, and then we get back to what we've been talking about, and the rest of it is all pretty well, I think, put to rest. And there's just that one little piece that we've been talking about.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parkinson.
Just to visit a minute maybe with Bernie, but Bernie, it sounds like you're of the opinion that if there isn't direction given to the agency to cite these smaller resorts on at least some kind of secondary land, you've lost the battle.
Well,
that's a fairly true statement, isn't it?
I guess it, I don't know if it's, yeah, in a sense, Representative Parkinson, but there's this about it. Look. We're here now, we're in session, we're winding down, we won't get another bite at this apple. We represent the people of the state and make the laws and so forth. I think that as Mr. Benner says, you know, the commission has been responsive in terms of attempting to worry its way through the whole issue of the secondary resource lands and try to find something out. And I'm not in any way trying to impugn any, you know, lack of good intentions on their part. It's just that I guess I'm still a gimlet-eyed old boss, and when I've got a job to do, I like to see it done while we're in session, and I would like to just have some pretty strong direction go out, and I don't know the proper form and style for it. I think we're very close to that. That says, look, fellas, it's the policy of the people of the state of Oregon that we're going to facilitate the development of these kinds of things under these terms and conditions. And I think that we ought to say that while we're here and get it done.
Well, let me ask you this. Final little details of mapping or whatever it's going to be to the commission.
Which I think is appropriately their role, but I think that we're talking about a policy issue here that, you know, that not trying to tell them exactly how to do everything. I think that, you know, our discussions, maybe you'll agree, Dick, we're not trying to get down to the kinds of technical and policy, technicalities that the commission normally deals with. But we're we're turning on a kind of philosophical point relative to, if you will, what the legislature ought to be saying and what the commission ought to be doing within the framework of what the legislature says.
Anyone else? Can we come to closure or not on this bill?
Well, Representative Feast, Mr. Chairman, I'm satisfied personally to not try to, it's never been our intention to disrupt some process that's already in progress. I would say that. So, you know, philosophically, I'm not opposed to having the whole issue of the identification of secondary resource lands completed, and don't want to do anything that would muddy that process, particularly since I'm told it's close to closure. So fine, why not? That would be foolish to upset that apple cart now.
Mr. Chairman? I'm being awful mouthy. I apologize if I'm bothering anybody, but
don't apologize.
Couldn't we put a statement in there?
Go ahead.
That it's the policy of the state to develop smaller resort destination resorts on some secondary lands, and let the commission, by rule, come up with the procedure. Then that shouldn't upset Mr. Benner's secondary lands thing. I don't think, Dick.
Representative Parkinson,
and it wouldn't be on all your land, all the secondary land.
I think that's what Jim Ross was suggesting.
On some, a minute ago. some secondary land.
Such secondary lands as the commission deems appropriate.
Yes, but the language we've seen in either draft wouldn't do that.
Not yet. No.
Well, let me ask you. Let me ask you if we can do this. A couple of our members have had to go to the speaker's office for a meeting. And with word that I'll call them when we're ready. I'm wondering if we could temporarily close the work session on this bill and ask the four or five of you if you can, within the next hour, half hour, I think we're very close here, if we could come up with some resolution of the language that might solve that while we go on to our next work session on another bill. And if you can come back with closure, we can move and move it out. Yes, Representative
Rhea. I'd like them, if with their permission, to discuss Mr. Ross's amendment and Representative Parkinson's idea of sunset.
Yes, we can do that too. I'm asking all of them. The sunset, you can consider whether you want to do that. You suggested 8 years. I don't know that I have any great problem with it.